For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson, and I'm talking with the folks from Rubia, which is an organization that works in both Afghanistan and in Portsmouth. We're talking with Rachel Lair and Jeannie Fries. And let's start off with talking about what it is that that Rubia does.
Rubia works in Afghanistan, has worked there for a couple of years now with women in the countryside and in the capital city of Kabul, providing income and education in a land that is devastated by war and drought.
Okay, and Rachel, you were just there recently in Afghanistan, sorry.
Yeah, I just came back at the beginning of September. I was there for part of the summer. I was working on helping with the training that we were doing. We recently trained 200 women in the countryside to do sort of advanced embroidery, training them how to work, how to take instruction, how to do fine work, working with the materials that we use there, setting up a literacy project for the women that we work with. Part of what we do in Afghanistan, too, is look for marketing for our materials, selling our work both in Kabul to the foreign community there and finding the marketing venues outside of Afghanistan. For instance, we sell quite a bit of the work that the women do here in the United States, in particular in New Hampshire.
So you actually see some parts of Afghanistan firsthand. That, I mean, not that there are hundreds of people from the U.S. going over visiting Afghanistan, but generally speaking, most folks from the states who go there are pretty much confined to Kabul. And you go out to other parts of it and see it. Where in Afghanistan are you going to?
You're right. Not only am I not confined to Kabul, but I travel with Afghans and live with Afghans, which I don't know any other Americans who do. And we're working in an area called Dar-e-Noor. It's a valley called Dar-e-Noor, which means Valley of Light. It's outside Jalalabad. It takes about 3 hours from Kabul, going east to Jalalabad, 3-4 hours by road, depending on the conditions, and then another hour or so to get up into the valley north, into the mountains. And that road is only about 20 miles distance, but it's such bad condition that it takes a long time to get there. So I'm really lucky. I speak Afghan Dari. It's a language I studied back in college and have been able to pick up again, and have really done all the work I do using that language.
Have you ever had an experience? I mean, that you're talking about an area of Afghanistan that most people from the United States would probably not want to go to, because it's known to be a rather dangerous area. Have you ever felt afraid while you were there?
I've never felt really afraid in Afghanistan. And for a lot of the foreign workers, the American workers who are there, they would love to be able to get out and get into some of those areas, but they're not allowed to. Their security is such that they're kept from leaving the embassy compound or the place that they work. Most of the foreign aid workers work in an office. They have a driver that takes them home, and then they go back to the office in the morning. They're not allowed these days even to walk around the streets of Kabul. My experience is the complete opposite. I don't get to work in a nice office, and I don't have that kind of nice driver, but I do get to go wherever I want to. I am on the listserv for, or it's a list that comes out from the U.S. Embassy, the warden's list, that tells you the dangers every week, and it'll tell you who's been kidnapped last week or who was almost kidnapped. And for the last couple weeks, there's been this warning that goes out that says, for Americans should not be on the Kabul-Jalalabad road because there's known to be a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device. It says VBIED, and then it explains vehicle-borne improvised explosive device along the road there. And in fact, the most recent one said, this vehicle will be parked at a gas station. The hood might be up. It might look like somebody is checking the oil. I couldn't believe this one. Like, we're supposed to be looking out for these things, but best of all, just don't go on that road. And most foreigners don't go on that road. They'll fly back and forth. But I travel that road, and I just don't. I wear burqa when I'm traveling in Afghanistan so that people don't recognize me as a foreigner. And I guess we won't be stopping at any gas stations sometime soon.
Yeah, make sure you got a full tank before you head out.
I mean, it's so bizarre. You gotta see these warnings. They're just bizarre.
Well, I've seen some of the work that the women in Afghanistan do, and it's absolutely beautiful. Jeannie, as you're an upholsterer here in town, and you have sort of a special relationship with Rubia. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, when I traveled over a couple of years ago to Kabul, I met with one of the women and we developed a business relationship where she does one-of-a-kind pieces for me to put specifically on one-of-a-kind pieces of furniture. So I sell those, and also we raffle them off as fundraisers for the organization. But that's a separate business, and what I'll do is donate about 10% back to Rubia and then pay Hafiza directly for her product.
Okay, and while we're on the subject, where can we find the Rubia products here in New Hampshire?
We are selling at European Home right now. They've opened up part of their store through the month of October for all of our product. So we have our full line displayed there. And we also have a chair and a tote bag being raffled for a fundraiser. European Home is behind the Portsmouth Herald, and it is on Vaughan Street.
We also have a show coming up starting on November 4th. We have a show opening up at Little River Oriental Rugs on Main Street in Concord, right at the heart of downtown Concord. And that show will run through the month of November, featuring our whole line of products.
Does Rubia have a website, and can you give us the address for that?
Rubia has a website. It's rubiahandwork.org. Some of the current information is on there. We'd love to have people volunteer. We have a wish list. So anybody interested in helping us with our website or graphic design or some technical issues, design issues, we have lots of people have come to us asking how they can help us. So people have given us sewing needles and threads and yarns and fabric. What else have people given us? Clothing that we have sent to Afghanistan. All kinds of things that should be listed on our website. You know, one of the things I think that's interesting is that here we are in rural New Hampshire, and Afghanistan, for the most part, even in the city of Kabul, is pretty much a rural country. And there's that connection of rural to rural, of being concerned about people who are tied to their land and connected to their land in a way that we can appreciate in New Hampshire. And developing not only as a larger organization and business relationships, but also individual relationships. For example, Jeannie, taking the risk of going to Afghanistan and meeting a woman there and developing a business relationship is fabulous. And other artists have come to us and said, I'd like to do some design piece for you. And working with people directly in Afghanistan, it keeps coming up. And I think it's a strong New Hampshire-Afghanistan connection.
Rachel, one of the things that seems to always come up in terms of, you know, when we talk about Afghanistan, even in the now post-Taliban era, is relationships between men and women. You know, there's the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan that have done a lot of really brave work in Afghanistan for many, many years. They were kind of a focal point in the media prior to the U.S. invading Afghanistan and helping to oust the Taliban. But now we don't really hear from them so much, and it's not because they're not there, they're still there and doing great work. But there's almost a sense, and I was told this by some very prominent women in Afghanistan when I was there in 2004, there's almost a sense that from the Afghan perspective, people in the United States just think that everything's just fine now with, you know, with women and how they're treated in Afghanistan and those kind of things. What are you seeing when you're there?
I think the initial stories that came out after the fall of the Taliban was these images of women tearing off their burqas and going out in public, and it made a big splash, but it's not representative of what life was like in Afghanistan or is like now. So many people say to me when they see the burqa that I have, oh, women are still wearing burqas, because they remember them taking them off. The burqa's been a part of Afghan life for a long time. It's an old tradition of theirs. It's not part of every tribal group. The tribal group that we work with, it is their tradition, and women continue to wear the burqa. That burqa is perhaps representative of the relationships between men and women that certainly we don't expect to change in a short amount of time. In general, in Afghanistan, men don't respect the women very well. In general, people are poorly educated. I don't know what the statistics are, but it's something like 90 to 95% of women are illiterate. So sometimes we're thinking about the women from Rawa, we're thinking about the 5% in there, and that the women we work with are perhaps more representative. And so their opportunity to work is a first step in gaining perhaps some more respect within their family and more independence. They have some money that they've earned and that they are part of the decision making and how it's going to be spent. So, for instance, the women who I work with, that we work with in Rubia, have a lot of issues about whether they can be photographed or not. And I'm a photographer. Of course, I love to photograph the women there. They're very happy to be photographed, and I have a really wonderful body of work that really is beneath the veil in terms of what I've been able to see, but I can't exhibit that easily. So recently, I wanted to photograph the women with their embroidery and asked if I could photograph them with their burqas on, because that way their faces not being seen won't bring shame to their family. That's the way it works in Afghanistan. So my recent photos are of women in their burqas standing there holding their embroidery. And the statement is quite strong, I think, a stronger statement than maybe seeing who they are, but knowing that there's a woman behind there and that this embroidery is representative of who she is, and she signs her name on her embroidery. It's part of making a statement about herself, but yet you still can't see her. When we first started our project, we wanted to bring both literacy and income to the women. And we started this project 5 years ago in Pakistan with a group of refugees, Afghan refugees. It was before 9/11, and we had no notion that we would ever come back to Afghanistan. And when we first started, we thought, we should get these women going to school. They should start taking classes and learn to read and write and embroider. And we found pretty early on that we couldn't force anybody to do that. We could offer them the hook, but we couldn't, of the embroidery to bring them in, but then we couldn't force anybody to go to classes. So we offered both opportunities. And one of the emblems of what we were doing is to have women sign their name in stitchery on all the embroidery they did, and in their language, which is a very beautiful cursive script that, 99% can't read here in the United States. So it looks very pretty, but it helps us identify who's done what work, and it's, for most of the women we've worked with, the first time they've ever written their name. So it's a big step for them as well. And in Afghanistan, most people don't have last names. Women in particular don't have last names. So just putting that first name out there is a big deal. And as it turns out, after several years of doing this, there was some objection to women putting their names on their work. Some men said, this is shameful for us that our women's names. It's been our mission has always been to tread very lightly on the culture, which means we don't come into an area and say, all right, all the ladies, come on over here, we're gonna get you this or that. We're very patient. We take our time. We want to make a difference in their lives, but we want those differences to come about slowly so that they are real and meaningful.
I think a large portion of the U.S. side of things too is to educate the people in the U.S. too, to make them understand that all of the issues aren't so black and white, that they're different shades of gray depending on what the cultural background is.
Very ancient, very complex culture and tradition. You're right, Jeannie. And we give slide and video lecture presentations. We will talk to anybody about Afghanistan. We're delighted that The Kite Runner is such a big bestseller, because every library in the country, it seems, is having a reading group around The Kite Runner. And so people keep asking us, is that what it's like? Or did he do a good job? Is it true? Or I've been invited to speak at several libraries about Afghanistan. So all of those things are, we don't want Afghanistan to fall off the page. It's sort of fallen off a little bit, and things are not hunky-dory.
It's okay. And it's all about gradual change.
It's all about gentle, really, right? Well. Gentle. Mm-hmm. You have to be patient. People working in development don't have that luxury in a way. They've got to make big changes fast. They've got a lot of money that's got to be spent quickly. They build buildings, they build roads. They don't really care if those roads or buildings are there in a year or two or three. We come from a different place. We come from a place where we're going to be around for a long time working with this community, and we want the change to really make a difference.
Jeannie, had you been to any sort of, very poor country prior to going to Afghanistan, and really, I guess, whether you had it or not, what can you talk about your impressions, just sort of some of the basic impressions that you had while you were there in terms of what you were seeing and...
Actually, I could have my own show about that. But no, I hadn't traveled to any country that was a third world country. I had been to Western Europe and traveled quite a bit, but I had never experienced anything like Afghanistan before. But there is something about the country that makes you want to go back. It's actually a beautiful country, as you know, from your travels. But I went with a little trepidation, but once I got there, everything became relative. Even safety issues seemed not quite so... Something that might be frightening here just became kind of nothing over there. It was everything in perspective.
People do describe... I've heard aid workers describe Afghanistan as addictive. It's one of those places that if you've been to, it grabs you in a way and holds on to you. Have you experienced that yourself?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so Jeannie really took a big step, and it's holding
not only the land, but the people,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, there's just something about it.
Hospitality is such a big, you know, that's their claim to fame.
Mm-hmm. And they do it well, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do, yeah.
Even if they have nothing but, you know, a little bread and water, they know how to make you feel like you're really, really just what they've been waiting for all day.
Well, and I think that's what I took away that impressed me most was just how much we have and how much opportunity we have here that we take for granted sometimes. And, you know, I'm grateful for what I have, and I always have been grateful, but since coming back, I don't take it for granted. Every day, I feel very fortunate to have what I have, and it may sound a little bit corny, but it's true. And just having the freedom to, you know, be a woman, to have a business of my own and be able to walk around town by myself.
Up in your car, go somewhere, all those bits of independence that...
Yeah, things that we really take for granted. And having a car of my own and being able to pick up and go whenever I want to. And it's everything about the country is different, but great. It was a great experience. The food was different. It was much more limited, but you know, you sit down and they make you a lunch of anything and everything that they have available to them, which might not be a lot, but it's a great meal. And you know, it's very community oriented, very tribal society.
But when you think about the security that they might feel, or I think about children's self-esteem, or the security of having your family around you all the time and feeling, you know, very safe in that, considering it's a pretty hostile world out there in Afghanistan, that I kind of admire what I see there in mm-hmm. terms of the family units.
Yeah, and they're there for each other. It's a very supportive family unit, extended family unit. You know, if you think of all the turmoil they've had and all the men that have died in the past wars, you know, that the families are there, that they take care of each other.
Yeah, never any question about taking care of each other, bringing extra people into their household. It's aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins, and it's all the same. It's all the same there. They don't have nursing homes in Afghanistan. And I don't know if you remember, but one of the first reports when the U.S. started bombing Afghanistan was about bombing a nursing home in Herat. That was one of the first news reports, and I thought, now something's really wrong here, because there's no such thing. That's my first indication that maybe, you know, we weren't getting it right.
Rachel Lair and Jeannie Fries, thanks a lot for being with us on Making Waves today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.